Welcome to Christ Church Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com. My home is not on this
earth, not in this world. Well, good morning, everyone who's left after kids have left for kids' work. It's great to see you all here this morning. This is my first time, I think, preaching at Kingsway. First time here, so really good to be here. I know it's summer. I know loads of people are away. It's the same at Lady Barn, but yeah, it's great to be here. And well done. I just want to add to the fun day yesterday. I mean, I was here along with Elizabeth and Max, and it was really good. You did a great job. And I know I've organized a lot of fun days myself. It's a lot of work organizing them, so well done. You did a really good job. So I just want to start this morning by telling you about a friend of mine called Ron. First met Ron about 10 years ago when he was in his mid-50s. And he'd just been made redundant in his work. And he came along with his wife to a Christianity Explored course that we were running at my old church. Now, Christianity Explored, for those of you who don't know, is pretty much like Alpha, pretty similar to that. And we were running it in the local Costa coffee shop. And he came along with his wife, him and his wife. He wasn't a Christian, his wife was a Christian. And they ended up sitting on my table, a kind of discussion group table. And he came along every week and he started to just really get into it, really enjoyed the discussion, really enjoyed watching the videos, and we could tell really quickly that God was really doing something in this guy's life. And we got to the end of the course. It was about 8 weeks long, and I said, "Hey Ron, look, do you want to start meeting up each week? We could, you know, study the Bible together." So he said, "Yeah, that'd be great." So each week, each Wednesday morning, I'd go over to his house, and we'd get open the Bible, and we'd study it together. And he was a real kind of intellectual kind of guy, so we studied through Romans together, which is pretty deep, but he loved it. So we'd go through each week, we'd read a passage, we'd discuss it, he'd ask me questions, I'd try and answer them. And then about two-thirds the way through Romans, so we'd be meeting about two and a half months, I just said, "Ron, mate, can I ask you a question?" He was like, "Yeah, what?" I was like, "We've been doing this for a while now. Who's Jesus?" And he's like, "What?" I was like, "Who do you believe Jesus is?" And he's like, "Well, I mean, it seems to be that he's the Son of God. Like, all the evidence points to that." And I was like, "Well, do you believe that?" I was like, yeah, I believe that. And I believe all the stuff about the cross and him dying on it for my sins. Yeah, I believe all that too. And I was like, "Well, Ron, you know that means you're a Christian now." And he's like, "Oh yeah, I suppose it does actually. I'm a Christian now, yeah." So we kind of prayed together, and he prayed and I prayed, and his wife was there sitting with us, just crying her eyes out, because she's just like, "I've been praying for him to become a Christian for the last 30 years, and finally he's just given his life to Jesus." And it was a great, great moment that we had right there. And we continued meeting after he'd given his life to Jesus for another maybe 6 months or so, just kind of going through the rest of Romans, went through Mark, went through a few other different books. But looking back, my time with Ron, meeting up with him, we met for about a year and a half, it all built up to me asking the question, "Who is Jesus?" And after he'd answered that question, everything was different. So before that, it was all about him finding out, "Who is this Jesus?" And then he realized who he is. And then after that, all our Bible studies were about, basically, how do I live as a Christian? So everything changed with that question. And I just want to say, who is Jesus is the most important question any of us will ever answer in our lives. Because our answer will not only dictate how we live our lives, but it'll also dictate where we spend eternity. And this is the question Jesus asks his disciples in Mark chapter 8, verses 27 to 38, which is the passage we're going to look at today. Now, I'll let you into a little bit of a secret. Now, I know you're going through a series on Mark here. Whenever I do a series, and if I have to invite a visiting preacher, I usually give them the passage that I don't want to preach on. You know, so I'll find a passage, I'll be like, "I don't really want to preach on something to do with uncleanness." So I'll say, "Hey, Colin, I want you to preach at Lady Barn. It's a great passage." And Colin's like, yeah, fine, great. So that's what I normally do. Well, Tim is a nicer guy than me. I mean, Tim comes to me and he says, did someone just laugh there when I said Tim's a nicer guy than me? Was that? No, it wasn't. Okay. If it was, I'm really pleased with that. Tim goes to me, "Andy, we've got this series. Why don't you come preach? Just look at the sermon series, all the ones that I'm down for. Just pick one of them, pick whatever one you want. So I was like, sweet. So I looked down and I thought, okay, well, Tim is down for the central, the main passage, the big one in Mark, so I'm going to take that one. So that is what I've done. So I have chosen the best one. So yeah, but as I said, Mark chapter 8, verse 27 to 38, this is the crucial passage in Mark's gospel. It's the turning point. It's the passage in which the whole book hinges. The whole book hinges on this. And kind of like Ron, everything in Mark before this passage is different to everything that comes after it. Okay, everything before this passage is building up to it, making us ask, who is this guy? Okay, so all the stuff you come before, you got the calming of the storm, you got the feeding of the 5,000, you got walking on water. It's all this stuff is designed for us to go, who is this? Who is this? Who is this? Who is this? And then in this passage, we get the big reveal of who Jesus is. And then everything after that is this journey to the cross. Everything after that is this journey to the cross. Okay, so for example, before this passage, there's loads of miracles and not so much teaching. After this passage, there's loads of teaching and not as many miracles. Before this passage, Jesus tells people all loads of the times, don't tell people about me. Keep quiet. Don't say anything, okay? Because he's not wanting to... He wants his disciples to understand who he is before he starts spreading the message. And also, he doesn't want this kind of premature people rising up and making them this political messiah thing. He says, keep quiet. After this passage, though, sends them out to preach the good news. Okay, tell everyone. Okay, so we've got to change that. And also, before this passage, Jesus is generally pretty popular. After this passage, they hate him and want to kill him. So this is the hinge passage. This is the big one. Okay, so I'm just going to read the passage and then just share a few things we learn about who is Jesus. It's not going to be rocket science here today about stuff we're going to learn about who is Jesus. You've probably heard most of it before, but it's good stuff to be reminded of. So Mark chapter 8, verses 27 to 38. I'm going to read it here. I think it'll be, it's going to be up here. You can follow along in your Bibles if you want. It says this: Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. This is a village in the north of Israel. It was a Gentile village, so basically non-Jews. And on the way he asked, who do people say I am? Verse 28, they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked, who do you say that I am? Looking to his disciples. Peter jumped in first. Peter answers, you're the Messiah. And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Because as we see, Peter gets that he's Messiah, but he doesn't get the whole picture yet. Verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. Get behind me, Satan, he said. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Then verse 34 continues. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. So this is the passage where Jesus reveals who he is. And I just want to just share a few things with you this morning. A few things we learn about who Jesus is from this passage. Now, first thing I want to share about who Jesus is from this passage is the really obvious one. It's the super obvious one, is that he's the Messiah. Okay? It's what Peter says, verse 29. Can't miss it. That's the first thing we see in this passage. Now, before we go any further into this, many of you know I have a son, Max. He's 2.5. And he screams a lot and makes a lot of noise and he tantrums, all that, does all that. And I have to look after him on a Wednesday. That's my day to look after Max. Elizabeth works on a Wednesday. And what I've started to do when the weather isn't great, which has been most of June, is I put him on the bus and we get the 50 bus from outside our house and we go all the way to Salford Keys. Okay, it takes like an hour and a half in traffic. And I normally do it in traffic to make it last longer. Okay? He loves it. He just sits there. He looks out. I have his little bag. I've got food. I've got toys. I've got everything in there. And we just sit and go the whole way right to the last stop at Salford Quays. And we get out of Salford Quays and we go to the Lowry for like half an hour. I buy a coffee and then we get in the bus and come the whole way back. And that just kills the whole morning. It is great. Okay? So just Wednesday past, while I was doing this, we get to the city centre. I do it quite early because he's up early. So we get to the city centre about 9:15. And I'll listen to sermons and music and stuff. And I'm listening to this sermon about this passage. And I'm just watching all these people go to work, like all kind of going to work in the city centre. And I just thought to myself, I wonder, like, if we did a poll of all these people I can see right now, and you asked them, who is Jesus? Like, what would they say? What would they say? And I imagine it would be a complete, like, range of answers. And then just as I was thinking that, I remembered 10 years ago, I actually did this. I was organizing a youth conference, and we wanted this, like, kind of intro video where you kind of ask people, who is Jesus? And you kind of, I had a camera guy with me, and I went around and asked people, and they give an answer, and we kind of put it all together, and it was the intro to the youth thing. And I went around Manchester, and I asked loads of people, who do you think Jesus is? And I can remember some of the answers. There was loads of people said he was just a good man, good moral teacher. You know, a lot of the kind of Muslim people would say, oh, he was a prophet. Some people would say, like, I just don't believe in Jesus. You know, a lot of people actually just said, I've just no idea. Never really thought about it, to be honest. You'd some people who said, yeah, he's a savior, he's God, he's a son of God. So you just got complete variation. And this is kind of like what Jesus does here. He asked his disciples, who do people say I am? And he gets, there's a load of different answers. The disciples say, look, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. And then Jesus says, what about you? He asked, who do you say I am? And Peter, as is kind of usual for the disciples, he jumps in first and he's like, you're the Messiah. Or Christ, pretty much means the same thing. And Messiah, for those of you, can be a bit of a confusing word. Messiah or Christ, another way of saying it, pretty much means the anointed one. And it refers to a ceremony where oil was poured on someone's head, and this represented that they'd been chosen by God for a specific purpose. Now, being anointed wasn't all that specific in and of itself. I mean, there were lots of people who were anointed in the Old Testament, but the prophets in the Old Testament predicted there would be the one who would come called the Anointed One, the Messiah, a king with a capital K. And as you read the Old Testament, we see what the Messiah's job description would be. Okay, he would be a ruler of Israel, but also the nations as well. Basically a king of the whole world. And not a corrupt king, but a good king. Who would deliver people from oppression, who would rebalance injustice, would judge honestly, and would speak up for the downtrodden and the poor. And he would be chosen by God, but he would, in kind of this sense, kind of be God at the same time. He would be a divine king, someone whose rule would never end. And this is who Peter realized Jesus was. And as we see in Matthew chapter 16, which is the extended version of this conversation, Jesus pretty much says to him, correct, that's who I am. You've got it right. The prophets have been prophesying about this Messiah for 1,000 years. And Jesus says, yep, Peter, you think I'm the Messiah? Well, you're right, I am. That's me. That's who they've been prophesying for 1,000 years. And you know, for me, when I became a Christian, one of the most compelling things for me in terms of evidence for Jesus being who he was actually looking at the prophecies in the Old Testament, knowing exactly when they were written and what they said about Jesus, adding them all together and realizing it would be impossible. It's impossible for this man to be anybody else than the Messiah. Like, it's just not possible. I know we believe by faith here, but actually add that together, it's just not possible. It had to be the Messiah. And for me, that was a really important thing for me and my journey to believe in that Jesus was who he said he was. Okay, so that's the first thing we see from the passage about who Jesus is. He is the Messiah. Okay, we're in church here. That's probably not news to anybody, yeah? So the second thing, though, we see about Jesus, about who Jesus is, is that he defies expectations. Okay, it's a bit of an understatement. He defies expectations. Now, Peter has done pretty well so far. Jesus is like, who am I? And Peter's like, you're the Messiah. Jesus is like, correct. And Peter's probably looking around disciples saying, thinking, oh, I didn't hear any of you say that. Eh? I've got the right answer. High-fiving a few of his mates and thinking, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm the man here. And Peter normally wore his kind of heart on his sleeve. So it's probably what he was doing. then Jesus starts to explain what that means. He starts to explain what will happen to him. And then he says he will suffer many things. He will be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. And he will be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. And what happens next is just, it's kind of a bit unbelievable, really. So Jesus shares this, and then Peter says, Jesus, word please, come over here. Jesus, look, I know it's a real sunny day. It's hot. You know, we're all tired. It's a long journey. You know, look, just enough of this silly chat about, you know, the rejection and the suffering, okay? We're ready to kind of come in with you, Messiah, guns blazing, take Jerusalem. But this suffering rejection chat, let's just, Jesus, let's leave that, okay? Peter pretty much tells Jesus off, okay? He's just declared that Jesus is the Messiah and then proceeds to tell him off. You think, my goodness, like, you've just realized he's Messiah. Like, come on, listen to the guy. But he tells him off. He's annoyed at Jesus. Why is he annoyed at Jesus? He's annoyed at Jesus because Jesus doesn't fit his idea of what the Messiah would be. Jesus doesn't fit his idea of what the Messiah would be like. But, you know, I was thinking, you know, don't we often do the same thing? Like, don't we often think the same thing? You know, we think Jesus should act in a certain way, and when he doesn't, we get annoyed at him. You know, Jesus, my life wasn't supposed to turn out this way. You should have given me that thing. You should have answered that prayer, and you didn't, Lord. And we get annoyed at him. Why? Because Jesus isn't the way we expect him to be. He doesn't answer our prayers the way we expect him to be. You know, you haven't answered this prayer. It's a good thing I'm praying for, Jesus. Come on, answer it. Or why haven't you taken this pain and suffering away, Jesus? Come on. And you know, we think of have him all figured out, and then when he doesn't meet our expectations, we get annoyed at him. I mean, we might even tell him off. Jesus, you're supposed to answer my prayers the way I want them answered, Jesus. Come on. And you know, so often we can do this. But you know what? He doesn't just do what we expect. He defies our expectations. And the reason he defies our expectations is he's God. If he just fulfilled our expectations, he'd just be a figment of our imagination. It'd just be this God we made up in our head. It'd be like a genie. But he defies our expectations. That's what he does, because he's God. And you know, I think for me, in my life, I experienced this probably 5 or 6 years ago. I started to have, I don't know how it came on really, but I went to the doctor to see what it was. And he said it was mild anxiety. I was just anxious about everything. It lasted for about a year, you know. And just anxious about loads of stuff, like silly stuff. Stuff I shouldn't get anxious about. Never did before. And obviously I was at church and it was really debilitating. It affected me a lot. I just I couldn't do things I could normally do. And I prayed lots about it. I prayed in church. I got people to pray for me. And it just didn't seem to go, you know. And I expected God, look, God, this is not good. Take this away so I can function properly, so I can do stuff in church. And he just didn't. And I was like, this is not what I want. This is not what I'm expecting. And eventually, after about a year, it did end. But looking back, I can see how just having that kind of debilitating thing where I had to rely on others and couldn't do things myself for about a year, it gave me a lot of more compassion for other people who are going through stuff. And it actually increased a bit of my humility, and it smashed my self-reliance. I was always very much self-reliant, in control. I've got this one, God. It's all right, you take a rest. I'll sort this one. Completely blew that to pieces. I realized, no, I need God. I need others. I'm not just Superman. I can't do all this myself. I've been used to that. And it's interesting. When I look back, I realize what he did. He defied my expectations to do something better. Defied my expectations to do something better. Could he have healed me instantly? Of course he could. And that's what we see here with Peter. He defied his expectations to do something better. But as so often is the case when we're going through stuff, Peter couldn't quite see it yet. He couldn't quite see it yet. Now, all that stuff about the Messiah I told you about earlier, okay, Peter believed all that stuff. But Peter thought he knew the way the Messiah was going to do it. He thought he knew exactly how Jesus was going to do it. Peter thought the Messiah would raise an army, defeat the Romans, and ride victoriously into Jerusalem and sit on his throne. Peter thought he was going to be sitting on a horse just at the right hand of Jesus, following behind him. Yes, everyone, amazing. His right hand man, everyone, just so you know. That's how Peter thought it was going to happen. Peter thought he had the Messiah all figured out until Jesus comes and says, no, it's not going to happen like that. It's not going to happen. Like, no, I'm going to be rejected by the religious establishment. I'm going to suffer loads, and then I'm going to be killed on a cross, and then I'm going to rise 3 days later. Peter only sees who Jesus is partially, not completely. And just like the blind man who Jesus heals just before this story in Bethsaida, which you probably looked at in a previous week, Jesus, I don't know if you know the story, Jesus, this is a story where Jesus touches the guy's eyes and he can only see partially. He kind of sees something that looks like humans, but kind of blurry. And then Jesus touches him again and he sees fully. Now, the story of Jesus healing the blind man is intentionally put here by Mark. He's intentionally put here by Mark as a visual aid to show us the way the disciples will come to see Jesus, who Jesus is. It's put here to show us that the way the disciples are going to come to see Jesus will be gradual. They will see him a bit. They will kind of get it. Yeah, you're Messiah, but I don't fully get what that means. But then there will come a point where they see clearly. They understand him for who he really is. And Peter is in this kind of partially seeing first stage. And you know, as I was reading through this passage this week and thinking about it, I just had a real sense of God saying, or maybe it was just a sense in me, or whatever it was, I just had a sense of, you know, Andy, you're going to talk about this, who is Jesus, but Andy, who do you say I am? I just felt God say that to me. Who do you say I am, Andy? And I, you know, immediately, you know, pastor's answer, Jesus, you're the Son of God who died on the cross for my sins. You're the Savior of the world. You're the Messiah. I throw out all the big words, all the good answers, all the right stuff. All the stuff gets you good marks in the exam, you know? And I genuinely believe that. I believe it. But like, I realized, I just as I was saying that, just this other thought came to my head. And I do believe it was God as well. He just said, that's good, and that's right, but how much has that penetrated your heart? How much has that penetrated your heart? You know, it's one thing to believe it intellectually, but it's a different thing when it penetrates your heart. The extent to which it penetrates your heart is the extent to which your life changes for Jesus, okay? Not the extent to which you understand it up here. It's the extent to which you understand it in your heart. And that's what I realized just as I was thinking that. There's a quote I've heard a number of times. You may have heard it. The greatest distance in the world is a distance from here, the head, to here, the heart. So true. It's so true. You know, and I was whether I'm going to share this or not, but I'm thinking of when I first started going out with Elizabeth, and you know, she first said, I love you. There's like two ways to believe that. There's an intellectual way and there's like a heart way. The intellectual way is it's like an equation. She, Elizabeth, woman, right, loves, which is liking something very much, me, human, right, there you go, X plus X, you know, it's that kind of way, okay, I get it. But then there's another way of understanding it and believing it is when you be like, wow, she loves me, man, is she blind? Like, yeah, hey, I've done well here. And there's that kind of, it's a different thing, you know? And I think so often we can intellectually believe, but it just doesn't get too far in here. And I was thinking, like, you know, how do we allow that to kind of get into our heart? And I think, genuinely, it is just through just taking moments in our lives to just stop and think about it. That's it. To just, I'm not even talking about a quiet time here, to just take a moment every night again. Just stop, think, wow, Jesus died on that cross for me. He loves me unconditionally. He delights in me. I am his, and I will be with him in forever in heaven. Just be like, oh, that's real. That's true. You know, and I think just taking time. Sometimes I have a few little verses written inside my Bible that just are just real short verses that remind me of that. I'll just focus on them. Honestly, yesterday I was sitting watching TV, and Stormzy, who kind of headlined Glastonbury, was all over the news and all that kind of stuff. And I thought I'll just see what's on Spotify of Stormzy. And there's a song I've listened to before. It's the only song I've listened to of Stormzy. It's the only one that is not explicit content on Spotify. And it's called Blinded by Your Grace. And it's a song basically about the grace of God. And I listened to it. And as I listened to it, Elizabeth's like, what are you doing listening to Stormzy? Grace. God's grace is awesome. You know, just that moment where it just goes from here to here. And you're just like, ah. And I think we can live off that, you know, just a moment like that. We live off that for days, I think. And anyway, I'm rambling on. Yeah, right. Okay, that's second point. So where have we got to? Jesus, he's the Messiah. Amen to that. He defies our expectations. Third, final point is Jesus is realistic. Okay, he's realistic. Doesn't sugarcoat things. He says it like it is. And that's what we see right here. These are pretty hard, five really hard verses we're going to read right now. Really challenging, okay? And he says in verse 34, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny himself, take up their cross and follow me. Now today we typically use crosses as jewelry. Back then, the cross represented the most cruel form of execution that there was. It represented cruelty, it represented shame, brutality, and it symbolized the Roman occupation, and it was reserved for the lowest classes. Okay, you did not wear crosses around your neck. It's like wearing a guillotine around your neck. You just did not do that. And back 100 years before Jesus, there was a rebellion of people who rebelled against the Romans. There were 7,000 of them, led by Spartacus. Maybe you've seen the film. They just crucified them all along the road out of Rome. You could walk for miles. Crucifixes the whole way with guys dying, lying there for maybe 4 or 5 days until they died. So everybody knew about crucifixion back then. And Nero at the time was crucifying Christians at the time Mark was written. So people knew about crucifixion. So you think, why does Jesus use this image of the cross to describe following him? Because like, think about it, he hasn't even died on it yet. It's not like the thing that Jesus died on yet. It hasn't become that. Well, the reason he used it is because everyone back then knew that crucifixion meant giving up everything. It meant giving up everything. And that's what Jesus says it's like to be a follower of his, to give up every single thing for him. And then he gives these four reasons. Well, actually, no, before that, there's one commentator. He says this great quote, "The image of the cross signifies a total claim on the disciples' allegiance and the total, not partial, total relinquishment of his resources to Jesus." And there's four reasons. The last four verses are pretty much four reasons Jesus gives why we should deny ourselves, take up the cross and follow Jesus, despite how hard it is. Verse 35 is reason one. It says this, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it." Jesus is pretty much saying, you got a choice. Hold on to your life, live for yourself, live for the here and now purely, and you will die. But throw it away for me, and you will live. You will have eternal life. That's what he's saying, straight up. Say it like it is. Second reason Jesus says we should deny ourselves and follow him is verse 36. "What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul?" He's pretty much saying if someone comes along and says, "Nah, Jesus, that's too hard, I'm not following you," and they go out and they earn so much money and start the biggest company in the world and basically just gain the whole world, can they save their soul that way? No chance. No way. There's only one way to get saved. Anyone read Steve Jobs' book? Steve Jobs' biography, I read it last year. Really good read. He is a guy who did basically gain the world. Huge businessman, Apple, biggest company in the world. Can any of that save his soul? No, none of it can save his soul. And that's what Jesus is saying here. This is the most important thing. One of my favorite quotes from the Alpha Course, they always use this in the first week, is from Jim Carrey, you know, the actor. He says this, "I think everyone should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see it's not the answer." So many people striving for this, and he says, look, I've been there, it's not the answer. And that's what Jesus is saying, look, this is what you need to be focused on. Third reason why Jesus says we should deny ourselves and live for him is verse 37. "What can anyone give in exchange for their soul?" Jesus is pretty much saying there's nothing you can give in exchange for your soul. This is the only option, following me. And then the fourth reason, verse 38. "If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." This is hard stuff. This is hard stuff right here. Phil Moore, the commentator, says this. He says, "These are sobering verses, and they force us to make a choice. Hold on to your life and you will die. Throw away your life for Jesus and you will live. Confess your faith in Jesus, regardless of the cost, and he will confess that you are his. Deny him for the sake of this world, and he will deny you a share in the world to come. These are the terms that Jesus has set for all who follow him." Who wants to become a Christian? That's pretty much what he says. Now, I'll be honest, whenever I do talks where there's lots of non-Christians present, and I'm thinking, right, I'd like to share the gospel, I'd like people to become Christians, I don't tell it like that, you know? It's kind of, you know, being a Christian is really fulfilling and gives you a sense of peace and it's really good. And those things are all true, but Jesus here is saying it like it is. He's saying it like it is. He's realistic. And you know, the interesting thing is, all the disciples listening to this probably thought to themselves, oh my goodness, what on earth have we got ourselves into here? This is big stuff. But we know that after Jesus went back to heaven, all of them, apart from Jesus, fearlessly preached the gospel wherever they went. And all of them, bar John, was killed for doing so. And Peter, we know, was actually crucified in Rome for preaching the gospel. So he literally did take up his cross and follow Jesus. Now the reality is, in our society, we're probably not going to end up getting killed for our faith. So what does denying ourselves and taking up our crosses look like for us? Well, it's different for different people. But I was talking to a guy just a few weeks ago, actually, and he was sharing, he's a guy in the kind of late 50s, he was sharing about when he was back in his 20s, he was working for a large media company down in London. And he basically was invited for an interview for this other media company, huge multinational media company. They had loads of kind of publications, different things. And he realized when he went into the interview, it wasn't an interview, they were giving him the job. They said, basically, we want you to run this arm of our kind of media division. Now, this arm was a publication that he knew when he went in, he said, like, I cannot run that as a Christian. Okay, it's this sleazy kind of thing. And he knew he wouldn't be able to change it, because it made its money from being sleazy and awful and just terrible tabloid kind of stuff. And they said to him, we want you to run this organ, this arm of our business. And he said, no, I just morally I can't do that because I'm a Christian. And he says they took that as negotiation. So they doubled his salary. Oh, well, we'll give you double the money. And he was like, no, you're not getting me. I won't do it. And they said, no, well, we'll offer you that. So they upped his salary even more. And he said, it's almost like the devil was just like saying, no, take more. He says, look, I could have went out and bought the house of my dreams. I would not have had to worry about a mortgage, anything like that at all. But he said, I'm not going to be able to do that. And I was just, you know, the same guy, and this is 30 years later, he's still paying off his mortgage. He's still paying off his mortgage. And I just thought, you know what? That's denying yourself, taking up your cross, and following Jesus. Okay? And I was thinking about this for myself. What does this mean for me? A while ago, I was preaching somewhere, and it wasn't at CCM. I was preaching somewhere, and I think I preached a reasonably good sermon, and someone came up to me and said, Andy, that was great. Andy, you're going to lead a big church someday. They said that to me. You're going to lead a big church one day. And said loads of like really kind of like, you know, not that I need my head blown up anymore, but that was just... And he said this and it just got me thinking, you know. Wow, big church one day. And over quite a long time I'm thinking, oh yeah, that would be nice. Lights, big stage, you know. And this is all subconscious. You're never thinking this like consciously. But I'm thinking, oh, wow, that'd be cool. And then you think about other things. Oh, well, Would I go and plant this big church, or would I go to an existing big church, or all these? And I could do this and this and this. And then I remember thinking, and then just catching myself and realizing, wow, that's just all idolatry, really. I'm just looking at this and thinking, how can I get recognition? How can I do something? And this is in the Christian world, okay, to get as much recognition as possible. How can I get as many people as possible to say, Andy, you're awesome? That's essentially what it was. And it took me a long time to process that and figure that out. And it was probably about 2 months ago, I just felt the Lord, I just got to God and I said, Lord, I don't want that. I want to die to that. That whole attitude just stinks. And I was in Munich on holiday. I was sitting at a big cathedral. It was nice and cool, and there was no one there. And everyone knows prayers are twice as effective if you pray them in a cathedral. So I was there, and I was like, Lord, you know what? If I never get any more recognition from anyone, okay? It was one of those prayers. You know, you pray genuinely. Like it's hard, but like if no one even ever comes up to me afterwards and say, "Oh, that was a good sermon." And or if, you know, if I never get any recognition for anything I do in church, and what's more, if not only do I not get recognition, but other people get recognition for the stuff I do, you know. So instead of someone coming saying, Andy, that was a good sermon, someone will go to Tim and say, Tim, really good job in training that guy up. That was good. You know, it's that kind of stuff. If people do all that kind of stuff, and I just prayed to God, I was like, God, genuinely, honestly, if that's the way it's got to be, And, you know, if you want me to lead a church of 20 people the rest of my life, if that's the way it's going to be, I will serve you. I will do that. And it was one of those genuine, like, and it was a dying to something. It was a denying of something. And for me, like, that for me in this last few months has been something where I've kind of just had to be like, to deny myself something, saying, no, I'm not going for that. I'm going to follow you. I don't know what it's like for you. It's different people's context. But Jesus definitely says, hey, this thing's about denial. It's about denying ourselves stuff. And you know, when I read these verses, I'm almost finished. When I read these verses this week, the phrase that kept coming at me, these last five verses of this passage, was just, is he worth it? Is he worth it? We only deny stuff if it's worth it. And I just want to ask that question. Is he worth giving up everything for? Is he worth giving up everything for? And the reality is, he gave up everything for us. He gave up everything when he stepped out of heaven and came into this world to die for you and for me. He gave up everything at the cross for us so that we could be saved, so that we could be welcomed into his family and one day to be with him in heaven forever. And you know, what we lose in this life for him, we will more than make up for in the life to come. That's the truth. That's the reality.